I started going to the Elm City Vineyard, i.e. here, about 6 months ago. But I was also part of the home group out of which this church was planted several years ago. And the lapse that occurred between several years ago and 6 months ago has a lot to do with what I'm going to talk to you about today. And as Todd notified us, that is community. I have struggled a lot with the concept of community over the last few years, and I've learned some things, I think, through that struggle. And I've been wanting to share those with you because you're involved, and I think that you could benefit from knowing what somebody's gotten out of what you guys are into here. So because I had these things that I was learning, I said to Matt, when I was sort of finally ready to articulate them, I said to him, you know, when you have a series or something on community, let me know, because I have something I want to add to that, and here's what it is. And he said, you know, that sounds like we have something coming along those lines, actually. And so you're now in the midst of said series. Last week, you may remember that Matt discussed models of community. There was the tribal model on the one hand. And in this model, the people that belong to the tribe take care of their own very well, actually. However, the detraction from this model is that in taking care of so well the people inside, often people outside are neglected. On the other hand, Matt enumerated a model he called the universal model, which professes to love everyone, really. There are no boundaries, or rather, our boundaries know no bounds. This is also an attractive model because no one gets left out. However, as Matt pointed out, when you profess to love everyone in general, you often end up loving no one in particular. And so Matt tried to steer a course between the two, between the tribe on the one hand and the universe on the other hand. He called it a porous tribe. It's like a tribe in that it has a certain exclusivity. We do take care of our own and we recognize who those are. But it has an inclusivity in that its borders are porous, allowing for people to come in and out. Next week, Denise is going to talk about how exactly we allow people to come in and out through a process of adoption. What does that mean? How does that actually work to let somebody out, come in? And this week, my task is going to be to talk about what we're letting people into. Denise is talking about the porous side. I'm going to talk about the tribal side. What is a tribe? And how does our porous tribe embody that tribe-ness? So is it ready to... Okay. Well, adapter, no. Sorry, I do not have an adapter. I'm going to begin the discussion by talking about a verse from Romans, and if we had technology right now, that verse would be on the screen. The verse is, fortunately, short. It says, "Owe nobody anything but to love him. For one who loves another fulfills the law." Now, I think that we normally emphasize the last clause of this verse, which is, "The one who loves another fulfills the law." We're not under the Mosaic law anymore. We fulfill our law by loving people, like Jesus said in the Royal Commandments. This is undoubtedly what Paul is talking about here, because right after the verse that I just recited for you, he talks about how all the law hangs on the idea of loving one another, which is straight from Jesus. But even though that's true, it's not what I want to emphasize today. A number of years ago, I used to hear people emphasizing the first clause of the verse, which is to owe no one anything. By the way, my name is Brian McCarthy, and the McCarthy household is a Catholic household. But my mother really liked Christian television, and so even our Catholic Christianity took on a certain evangelical Protestant flavor. And one of the ideas that that my mom absorbed from this Christian television is that we shouldn't owe anybody anything. That is, we shouldn't have any debt, because, you know, Paul tells us not to owe anybody anything, and so we should not, you know, we should try to pay cash for our houses and not have credit cards and these sorts of things. This was fairly, a little more popular about 15 years ago, before the whole world ran on credit cards. But anyway, this model is problematic for obvious reasons, but I think it has some to come into it. Yet, this is still not the part that I want to emphasize today. What I would like to talk about is the middle clause, which says, along with the first, owe no one anything except to love him. So that means that, at least in terms of this verse, love is some sort of debt, something we owe. We're not supposed to owe anybody anything except in this one way. And loving is the way in which we owe people. But I think this is not really the way we think of love, right? I think that we think of love as something extra, almost. It's kind of hard to put a word on it. It's not exactly above and beyond, but neither is it part of the things that are exactly expected of us, right? It's kind of on top of that, and it shows that we're Christians and these sorts of things because we love, and it's something extra, sort of. Now, there are exceptions to this. We talk about loving spouses, and that's not really above and beyond or extra in any sort, really. We promise to do that from the beginning, and so when we do it, it's we're doing what we promised. It's not exactly something above and beyond the call of duty. But I think that most of the time, when we as a community say things like, we showed that person love, we don't really think of it as something that we owed that person. In fact, we might even say that if it's not freely given, if it's not our choice, if it's not extra in some important, significant sense, then it's not even love. What makes love love is that it's freely given. So how do we reconcile, then, this idea that love is something we owe with the idea that it's freely given? I would like to suggest that loving means entering a relationship of mutual debt. What do I mean by this relationship of mutual debt? Well, I'm going to get to that in a little bit, but first I want to show you a clip from the movie About a Boy. Many of you have seen this movie. It's not exactly an underground film. But I want to show several clips from it today because I think it demonstrates some of what I want to get at today in talking about community as being involved in mutual debt. So I'm going to back up one second. I just want to introduce it a little bit. This is going to say it's going to introduce the two main characters, Will and Marcus. Will is the older one, Marcus is the younger one. And it's going to introduce the idea that no man is an island. So these are the things you should watch for.
Okay, you ready for this?
As I'll ever be.
As you'll ever be. Okay, let's do it. Let's play Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Who wrote the phrase, no man is an island? John Donne. John Milton. John F. Kennedy. John Bon Jovi.
John Bon Jovi. Too easy.
and, if I may say so, a complete load of bollocks. In my opinion, all men are islands. And what's more, now's the time to be one. This is an island age. 100 years ago, for instance, you had to depend on other people. No one had TV or CDs or DVDs or videos or home espresso makers. As a matter of fact, they didn't have anything cool. Whereas now, you see, you can make yourself a little island paradise. With the right supplies and, more importantly, the right attitude, you can be sun-drenched, tropical, a magnet for young Swedish tourists.
Hi, it's Christina. I haven't heard from you. I had a great time last weekend, so give me a call, okay?
And I like to think that perhaps I'm that kind of island. I like to think I'm pretty cool. I like to think I'm Ibiza.
There were people out there who had a good time in life. I was beginning to realise I wasn't one of them. I just didn't fit. I didn't fit at my old school. I definitely didn't fit at my new one. I heard that some kids got taught by their parents at home, but Mum couldn't do that unless I paid her to teach me, because it was just her and me. And she went to work. She made £400 a week. Where was I going to get that kind of money from? Maybe if I was like that movie kid Haley Joel Osment, I could pay her that much. But if that meant being good at drama, forget it. I was crap at drama, because I hated standing up in front of people. So basically, I had to go to school.
The sad fact is that, like any island dweller, from time to time, I had to visit the mainland.
For the record, the answer to the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire question is not John Bon Jovi, but John Donne, who actually happens to be one of my favorite poets. He lived in the 17th century. I see we have a fan. He lived in the 17th century, and in his early life, he was sort of a Casanova, and he wrote all of these beautiful poems about his love for women. And a little later, though, he got really serious about Jesus and God and church, and he became an Anglican priest and wrote all of these really beautiful poems about his love for God in the same way that he had written beautiful poems about his love for women. And this phrase, "No man is an island," comes from one of his most famous meditations that happened in the later period. And I'm gonna read a little bit of it to you. I don't know how well you can see that, but it says, "The church is Catholic, universal. So are all her actions. All that she does belongs to all. When she baptizes a child, that action concerns me, for that child is thereby connected to that body which is my head too, and engrafted into that body whereof I am a member. And when she buries a man, that action concerns me. All mankind is of one author and is one volume. When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of a book, but translated into a better language. No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." Just to explain the bell part real quick, in John Donne's time, the way that you found out that somebody had died and that there was going to be a funeral was that they would ring the church bells. And people all over would run around asking if anybody knew who died. And that person would become the gossip conversation topic for the next few days. John Donne is saying, don't worry about who died, because you're dying too. I think he wants us to see each other not as separate, but as together, as a unit. That way, when we grieve over somebody's death, it's because a part of the body is dying. And someday, our part of that body is going to be dying, and we want others to be grieving for that part. And really, the whole body has a problem when somebody dies. So when the bell tolls, don't ask. Meditate. So the idea then is that we're not separate. We need each other. We need a community. And I think that both of the characters in this film eventually come around to realizing that.
We have to look after each other. The two of us.
Suddenly I realized, two people isn't enough. You need a backup. If you're only two people and someone drops off the edge, then you're on your own. Two isn't a large enough number.
You need three at least.
Three what?
Nothing.
But I'd had a great idea.
My life is made up of units of time. Buying CD. Two units. Eating lunch. Three units. Exercising. Two units. All in all, I had a very full life. It's just that it didn't mean anything. Only one thing that meant something to me. Marcus. He was the only thing that meant something to me. And Fiona was the only thing that meant something to him, and she was about to fall off the edge.
So, Will says his life doesn't mean anything. Marcus, he makes the point that two is not enough. I think that when a lot of newlyweds first get married and they're starting their lives out together, they're traveling around the country a lot trying to figure out where they're going to live and raise their family. And I think that a lot of the time, they end up sort of being the only ones that each other has. This is a lot like two islands, really, out in the middle of the ocean, with no diplomatic relations with any of the surrounding nations. And to be quite honest, I really thought that was enough for a long time. I thought, you know, when I got married, that would be kind of all I needed. And perhaps it's a good thing that I didn't get married, because I've learned the lesson that I needed to learn before that happened. But I had said earlier that I was going to explain what I meant by a relationship of mutual debt. And so I will now deliver on that promise. I think that a good friendship, when you're in one of those, you kind of stop asking the question, who does more for whom in the friendship, and whether you get out of it as much as the other person, or whether the other person gets out of it as much as you do, etc. You might stop trying to figure out who paid for dinner last, and they might be having a rough year, and you have to help them out 17 times. You're up at 3 in the morning, and You know, you just see them in church because you don't really have any problems that they need to solve at that moment. And you know that maybe in 15 years, you know, you'll get some disorder and they'll have to help you for a number of years, but maybe not. But that kind of thinking doesn't really cross your mind most of the time because they're just your friend. And that's what friends do. There's this sense that as long as they're around, as long as you're around, and both of you want that to continue being around, they're supposed to be there for you, and you're supposed to be there for them. It's a relationship of mutual debt. It doesn't ever end. There's not like a, I paid my debt off, you know, in a good friendship. There's just this sense that you just keep going, and you kind of stop keeping track of the score. But that's a friendship, right? What does this have to do with community? I'm going to answer that question autobiographically. I told you that I'd been struggling a lot with the idea of church. A number of years ago now, it's probably getting close to 10. I'm younger than I look, or rather older than I look. I'm younger than I look, too. I was part of a church where I was very close to the pastor, and the church decided that they were going to get rid of this pastor. They had a sort of a church meeting. Everybody showed up. There were people that showed up I hadn't seen in years, you know, because they were official on the books as members. And everybody got to take turns dipping in on what they didn't like about the pastor, and then there was a vote afterwards. I think I'm probably going to remember that day for the rest of my life because it was pretty brutal. Some of the venom of the people there was, I didn't even think church could be like that. And what I began realizing gradually with my feet kicking and dragging is that most churches are like that. And so I ended up leaving for other reasons. I didn't leave because of that. I was moving away, and I got involved with a missionary organization, and I was beginning to think about becoming a missionary. And the organization that I was a part of had bases all over the world, 1,000 or more, actually. And these bases offered training, and so I was really in the training phase at this point. And different bases offered different kinds of training, and some were in more demand than others, just like anything else. At the first base that I went to, I was completely in love with the whole thing. And I wanted to leave it, though, for a period of time because I wanted to take a biblical studies school that was kind of popular but wasn't offered at that base. It was offered at another base. And I really wanted to take it because I wanted to learn more about the Bible. And I went in to talk to the leader, the sort of the head honcho of the base that I was at, and to sort of discuss with him the prospect of coming back after I finished this school, because I really loved this base. I wanted to work for them, and they had some really interesting things that I was really into at the time, like they wanted to go to Iraq and stuff, and you should have seen me 10 years ago. But he said that it was his understanding that the school that I was going to, they had a reputation for being Calvinists. And if you don't know what that is, you're probably better off. But if you would really like to know, you can ask me later and I'll tell you. For now, we can just say that it's one of the more common theologies out there. Anyway, he said that it was his understanding that these people were Calvinist, and that if I came out of that school a Calvinist, I wouldn't be welcomed back there. And you know, that sort of turned me off. I didn't really want to be with them anymore, and it kind of shattered everything I was used to being a part of there. And, it actually got worse. I can't tell you the whole story. It's just too long. But after I went to the second base, a friend of mine who was around for that it's a cataclysmic event, mentioned it to one of the leaders there or something, which I would have never done, but it just kind of happened. And so they weren't Calvinists, so they were a little upset about this guy sort of spreading things around about them. And so they asked him at one of the national conferences and stuff, and he denied it, which was especially disconcerting to me because I knew he couldn't possibly have forgotten, because I'd just been emailing him back and forth to tell him that somebody had, who wasn't me, had accidentally sort of leaked it. And he was acknowledging remembrance then, and it wasn't that long after that. So he lied, basically. Which really, you know, just kind of got to me, because I just didn't feel like I could go back there. So I ended up getting out of the missionary training thing, again, for other reasons, mostly because I was thinking about whether I wanted to do a little more theological education and that sort of thing, and this organization didn't offer it. And I became part of another church. And I didn't stay there very long, because I had this weird sense, you know? Sometimes you just get a sense that something's just not right, and you need to get away from that. And that's kind of the sense I had. And it was interesting, because not very long after I left, not very long at all, actually, the church sort of dissolved for some weird reasons that I still don't understand. So, that is my experience with church in the last 10 years. This, in part, explains, though probably not excuses, the lapse between the years ago and the 6 months recently. And part of what's changed that is that I've sort of had an epiphany about it, I guess you could say. And what I realized is that the church ought to be what I describe in Friendship writ large. It ought to be a community of mutual debt, where everyone has a relationship of mutual debt to the collective. And that if somebody in the collective needs help, and I can help them, then I owe it to them to help them. And if they need, or if somebody else needs something from someone else, and they can provide it, if I can't, they owe it to them to help. And that we could all have the kind of community, the tribe that we want, where we take care of our own, if we saw church in this way. That was my epiphany. And I wasn't yet coming here again or anywhere. A while after I had the epiphany, something interesting happened. And this is where you guys come in. I had a friend who got... His landlord situation was such that they owned the house, but they had some financial troubles and they had to sell it. And so they were leasing the bottom room or something to my friend, and he had to leave because they were going to sell the house. So they made their arrangements to leave and everything like that. But then the landlords told him, you know, we've since become apparent to us that you actually need to leave earlier, a week earlier. And they had already... They'd already sort of booked flights and everything, and so they needed a place to stay for a week. And so I told them that I would figure out a way to make this happen, and I told them about you guys. And I was sort of peripherally involved at this point, but I sent out an email to the ECV community list that Todd told you about earlier. And I got a number of replies within only a couple of days, and almost all of them were people I didn't know. I was pretty sure they didn't know me. In particular, there was one woman named Rose, who many of you know, and who is, I think she's still in Africa right now. You've been following her walk. If not, you should check it out. And she emailed me and said that she was willing to help. What I later found out is that she had asked Hannah if, you know, who I was, and was I indeed a member of this community, this fellow who doesn't show up ever. And And Hannah said, yeah, you know, he's a good guy. He's part of the community, you know. He's probably a little weird, but he's definitely all right. And so she contacted me. But the thing that struck me is that what qualified me for her aid was that I was part of this community. I was part of this relationship of mutual debt. I mean, she didn't know me, right? There has to be some sense of obligation there, just somebody out of nowhere and you decide you're going to help them. But the prerequisite is somehow that you belong to the relationship of mutual debt, I'm calling it. Now, this is not at all to suggest that Rose, you know, wouldn't help people that aren't, you know, in the community, because, I mean, she's in Africa right now helping people not in the community, and she's just the way she is. She helps lots of people. But the point is that the occasion that provided, you know, what provided the occasion for her helping me was the fact that I was a member of this community. And so what I realized is that ECV, at least for some people, was functioning according to the model of community that I had absorbed in my epiphany. But isn't there a catch, you say? Couldn't this be abused? What if somebody wants your help and you really shouldn't help them because it's not safe? Or maybe they really shouldn't be asking anybody for that help. You know, maybe this is something they ought to be doing on their own and they're just being lazy or taking advantage of the community. Couldn't this be abused, you say? And I say, yes. Rose exercised discernment in the situation that I've described for you, right? She asked other people in the community, is this guy really part of the community? Do you think I should do this? And I think that on the fuzzy cases, the individual shouldn't make the decision, but the community should make the decision, as in that case. And I don't really think that guarantees us anything, necessarily, because the community makes mistakes too. And so it's always going to be imperfect, I think. But I think that we have to try anyway. I wanted to show a clip where the what I'm calling the catch sort of becomes very real in the movie.
Our next big act is Marcus Brewer, singing Roberta Flack's beloved Killing Me Softly. To be accompanied by Simon Cosgrove on the recorder.
Marcus, I can't do this. That looks gonna shit all over us.
But you said.
Yeah. I'm sorry, here's your £5 back.
Any moment now.
Wait.
Excuse me, what is going on here?
Nothing. Everything's under control. I'm just his voice coach.
What are you doing here?
I heard you were about to commit social suicide, so I thought I'd just drop by, you know.
My compass left.
Well, that's brilliant, then you don't have to do it.
I can't do that.
Yeah, you can. Just, you know, tell him artistic differences. You can't work without him. He had a drug problem. It's easy.
My mum wants me to sing it. It'll make her happy.
Look, Marcus, mate, nothing you do can make your mum happy, right? I mean, not in the long term. She has to do that for herself.
Get over here right now.
Yes, bugger off, will you? What I'm saying is, the important thing is to make yourself feel happy.
Try just making myself happy. She's tried making herself happy. But it doesn't work. You need other people to make you happy.
That's just it. If other people can make you happy, then they can also make you unhappy. What, you think those people out there are going to make you happy?
Hang on, wait. Marcus, don't. Marcus.
then they can also make you unhappy. If other people can make you happy, then they can also make you unhappy. This is true. People are going to be demanding. People are going to say that you owe them something because you're part of the community of mutual debt, when actually they're just not doing something they're supposed to be doing and you don't owe them anything. There are disadvantages to the community and there are advantages. They're both part of the package. But no one is an island. If we run away from what we perceive to be the disadvantages of the relationship of mutual debt, then we're going to be forced to live like an island. And since we're not islands, that's contrary to our nature. However, if we accept the disadvantages and we embrace the community of mutual debt, we get something sublime. We get what we need. We get the community. For the very last clip and the very last thing that's going to happen here today, in terms of me, we get to see a little bit of the community that happens in this movie. And you will notice, if you're paying attention, that Marcus says that it's great, mostly. That is, it's not great all the time. But everybody in the community embraces the community because in it, they find what they need.
By the following Christmas, things were back to normal. Before you came, every man is an island. I stand by that. But, clearly, some men are part of island chains. Below the surface of the ocean, they're actually connected.
So you're going to marry my mum, then?
Dunno. Why? You think she's up for it?
I used to want Will to marry my mum.
Serious?
Yeah, but that was when she was depressed and I was desperate.
Thanks, mate. Yes.
Will, how do you use this blender food?
You don't!
I used to think two wasn't enough.
Jesus Christ.
Now there were loads of people. And that was great. Mostly.
Oi! Are you two lazy bastards going to get up and help a walk?
So, how do you know Will?
Well, we volunteered together at Amnesty International a couple of years ago.
Yes, right. How is the Burmese situation, Tom? Better? I mean, good?
Yeah, and so he called me up out of the blue for Christmas lunch, so here I am.
Really?
So listen, what's the deal with you and Ellie now? I mean, is she, your girlfriend?
Are you insane? Where'd you get those trainers?
Well, what's wrong with them?
Nothing.
What?
By the way, I do think you and Rachel have a shot. I mean, if you don't screw it up.
Thank you. I'd created a monster. Or maybe he'd created me.
I don't know what Will was so upset about. All I meant was, I don't think couples are the future. You need more than that. You need backup. The way I saw it, Will and I both had backup now. It's like that thing he told me John Bon Jovi said. No man is an island.
I've been dreaming.